on Mondays for the next time, for indefinitely, I guess. I don't know how long it'll take. I am giving talks on the Satipatthana Sutta. I started last Monday. And the Satipatthana Sutta is the discourse of the Buddha, which is the foundation for all the different types of Vipassana practice that exists, including the type we do here. So go back to the source and kind of go slowly through it. And one of the practices, qualities that are discussed in the Satipatthana Sutta that comes near the end, so I'll give you kind of more the punchline so you don't have to go through all the, those of you who come on Sundays, is the seven factors of awakening. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the seven factors of awakening. And they're a very important list in Buddhism. And you might get a little bit discouraged or a little bit depressed when you hear, oh, we're going to go through one more list. Because and Buddhism has a lot of lists. And here we go again. And there have been times when I've given talks on lists that I also kind of lose heart a little bit in getting ready to give a talk. Oh, I can't go through 8 of these and 12 of this and in 45 minutes. And, you know, certainly people get bored and all that. But and sometimes it's said that the function of the list is mnemonic, partly to help us memorize and remember the teachings. But there's, I think, a more important aspect to some of these lists, and that is that they're kind of like a map of practice. They're kind of descriptive of some of the processes and experiences that we go through in meditation. And sometimes they're sequential. You can understand some of these lists as kind of a sequence of the kind of things you go through. If you want to go from here to Oakland, you know, there's a sequence of things you have to go through. You have to go on certain freeways and certain bridges and more freeways. And you can make a list. You know, probably someone gives you directions to their house in Oakland. You can go 1, 2, 3. This is what you do. So the seven factors of awakening can be understood as a kind of a map of practice. And it's been said that, you know, all of Buddhism is about awakening in some, to some degree or other, awakening and compassion together. And the word Buddhism comes from bodhi. Bodhi means to be awakened, to be awake. And here we have the seven factors of awakening. And it can be said, I think, very accurately, that the teachings of the Buddha are more instructions to awakening than they are teachings about awakening. So it's more like the map of how to get somewhere rather than the description of the place you're going to get to. So it's kind of emphasis. So the seven factors of awakening is part of this. Now, what's also interesting is that Buddhism is very process-oriented. Buddhism tends not to look at life as fixed things, that there's a fixed states we're in, fixed beings, fixed bodies, fixed experiences, but that all of human life is a series of processes. Our emotions are processes, our cognitive capacities are processes, everything's a process. And so meditation also is kind of tuning into the process level of life and participating in that process and being involved in that process to move the process of life, move the process of our life in a direction that leads to awakening, leads to greater happiness and compassion and wonderful aspects, peace. And in order to be engaged in a process, in meditative process, it helps to, I think it helps many people, not everyone, but it helps to know what some of the stages are, what some of the processes that will happen, what some of the things that will unfold as you engage in meditation. Because as you, if you know, have some sense of the general, very general sense of what might unfold as you meditate, I think it can be easier to get absorbed in the meditation, get involved in it, get engaged. If you don't have any sense of what's supposed to happen, and you do it out of faith, you sit down to be present, then it can be quite wonderful, but it also can be that, even if wonderful, it could be just kind of, you're kind of, you know, just kind of hovering for a long time in the same place. You know, it kind of helps a little bit if you know the process of what it's, you know, that involves getting from here to Oakland. Because then you can kind of prepare yourself and you know what's involved. If you don't have a map and don't know what's involved, you might get on the freeway and not have enough gas. And you end up stuck on 101 for a while until they come with gas. Or you don't know exactly, you know, you need to have toll money at least to come back. And so, you know, things you need to know, it's helpful. And if you don't know those things, then it's harder to kind of be engaged in the process in an effective way. Also, Buddhism puts a tremendous emphasis on getting absorbed in your meditative process. And so just like you get absorbed in reading a good book, you're absorbed in the book and you kind of forget about time, you forget about maybe what's around you and your problems, your difficulties, your work or whatever. You know, you forget about a lot of things. You're absorbed for that period of time in the book. Or if you're involved in play, you know, play can be, you know, some kind of, you kind of get absorbed in that play and you kind of lose touch with a lot of other things that normally might preoccupy you because you're absorbed in that activity for the time you are. So meditation is also meant to be something we get absorbed in, the kind of level that you get absorbed in reading a good book. And a lot of things drop away while we're absorbed in this play or this engagement with the meditative experience. And there again, I think it's easier to get absorbed in the process if you have some sense of what the process entails, what happened in the process, or the sequence, or the general kind of sequence in which meditation unfolds. It's said many times in the tradition that mindfulness meditation unfolds in a lawful pattern. There's a pattern in which it unfolds. So what is that pattern? If you know a little bit of the pattern, then is it easier to get absorbed in what you're doing? The danger in talking this way is that if you have too strict an idea of a pattern or a sequence, it can be kind of almost a violence to yourself because you're trying to overlay some other people's idea of what's supposed to happen on what's happening for yourself organically. And a lot of the beauty of meditation for many people is not imposing some other people's idea of what's supposed to happen, and just simply being awake, being present for your experience, and noticing what happens in that as that happens. So there's some danger in talking about a sequence or a pattern that we're involved in. But there are some very general aspects of this meditative pattern in the teachings of the Buddha. You have many different lists. You have the seven factors of awakening. You have things like the five faculties. You have the 12-fold chain of transcendent, the transcendental chain of dependent origination. You have there's a number of lists, and if you look at all these different lists, they have different aspects to the list, but they have some things in common: the Eightfold Path, in terms of meditation. One of the things they have in common, one of the overlaps they have, so this is kind of a general pattern that often you kind of, is that concentration tends to follow mindfulness. First you have mindfulness, and then as you develop your practice, as you develop mindfulness, there comes some concentration, some ability to focus, to be stabilized, to be present here. That's a very general pattern. You need to kind of be present in order to develop your concentration. There's also another aspect of this pattern, is that before concentration, there tends to be some emphasis, or there's joy. Joy or happiness. Joy and happiness. And so in the general pattern, in order to get concentrated, in order to move from where you are now through becoming mindful to becoming concentrated, we need to develop some capacity to be feeling, have a sense of wellness, sense of well-being in our body and our mind. A sense of joy, sense of delight, sense of happiness. And other aspects of this sequence that appears kind of tease all these different things apart is that somewhere between joy and getting concentrated, there is tranquility. We get calm. So you don't just kind of jump in, I'm going to get concentrated, and you know, I'm feeling lousy and depressed, and I'm just going to get concentrated and just burst through into some great altered state and be happy ever after. But I think it sometimes it might happen that way. Some people have tremendous, you know, drive that way and can do something, can get themselves into altered states. One person told me that he went on a 3-month retreat and he discovered that if he held his breath, at some point he would faint. And then when he woke up from his faint, he would feel really good. That reminds me of the story of a student who comes to his teacher and said, "This breath meditation, I find the breath really boring." And so the teacher takes him down to a lake and dunks his head under the water and holds him down there for about a minute or so and then lifts him up. Is the breath still boring? So there are extreme ways, you know. But so there's a sequence of mindfulness, of and then joy, happiness, tranquility, calmness, and then comes concentration. And then what kind of the general sequence after that is equanimity. At some point, equanimity arises. And equanimity is often one of the last thing that arises in this kind of sequence, because it's said that just before full awakening, the last kind of stage a person attains is equanimity. Mind is equanimous, and I'll talk about that a little bit. So these are kind of a sequence. And then, but also mindfulness is not just quite enough. Also, then following mindfulness has to become application. You have to do something. You have to apply yourself. The spiritual life, as I too many times say, is not just like reading, going to the restaurant, reading the menu, and never ordering the food. You have to at some point order the food. If you don't just read the instructions, sometimes you have to apply yourself to the instructions. There's some application that we have to do. We apply ourselves. So there's mindfulness. Then there's the application of the mindfulness, application in practice. Then there's the arising of some kind of sense of well-being. And then there's part of that well-being is factors of joy, and part of that well-being is factors of tranquility, of calmness. And then from that, there's that foundation, then there's it's a lot easier to develop concentration, to get focused and just be, you know, kind of one-pointed in our experience. And with that, then comes the possibility of developing equanimity to what's going on. So when we sit down to meditate, we get engaged in this process, and part of the engagement is beginning tracking where we are right now. What's happening with me right now? Who am I right now? What's happening in my experience right now? Is there a sense of well-being, or is there not a sense of well-being? Can I look for how to develop a sense of well-being in a realistic and healthy way? Can I tune in to that part of my experience which has well-being as part of it? Having a sense of well-being is an important part of the meditative experience. So as I get engaged in tracking and being present, can I look for the sense of well-being? Because one of the principles of Buddhist practice is that as you recognize what's going on inside of you, that recognition strengthens that which needs to be strengthened, strengthens the good qualities within us. And that recognition of what's happening within us weakens that which needs to be weakened, that which needs to kind of fall away, the unhealthy aspects of our experience. So we start bringing, a lot of the mindfulness is beginning to bring this recognition to what's happening in our experience right now. The seven factors of awakening begin with mindfulness. It's said that all the other factors come in the wake of mindfulness. If all you do is practice mindfulness, the rest of it follows. But if you know some of what's to come, you can kind of, in a very healthy way, and that might take you 10 years to learn how to do it in a healthy way, but in a healthy way, to then work and massage and look for those qualities that you want to develop in the present moment. And by doing that, maybe get more absorbed in a playful way, an enjoyable way, in what you're doing. Are you following me so far? Okay, enough. So the seven factors of awakening begin with our mindfulness, being present for our experience, tracking what our experience is in the present moment. And it's hard. Probably, 90% of the work of getting into the seven factors of awakening is developing the mindfulness. Don't be discouraged that developing mindfulness is difficult. The whole process of learning to be settled and be mindful is a phenomenally worthwhile process in itself. I'd encourage you to think of it as a wonderful adventure rather than a burden. And it takes a lot of wisdom to develop mindfulness. Partly because what mindfulness does, it reveals to us who we are, what's going on with us in the present moment. You might discover, for example, that you have a tremendously distractible mind. The last thing your mind seems to want to do is be mindful. It has a mind of its own. And so how do you engage with that in a very respectful way? How do you be very respectful? How do you engage with that in a useful way, rather than being upset, rather than being reactive, rather than giving up? All the different things a person might do when seemingly what we're trying to do is not working so well. We have to develop patience. It's maybe the first lesson of a meditator. We have to develop compassion. We have to develop a kind of sense of discernment. There's a lot of things we have to develop. We have to learn certain skills. Lately in my meditation, those times when I sit down to do my meditation, and I find my mind scattered, it's kind of hard to be concentrated or present, be mindful. I found it very useful lately to say the word here to myself. Here. Just I sit there and here. This is where I am. Here. 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 And just that time seems to cut through so much. You know, here. Right now, here, there's a human being who's thinking about the past, thinking about the future. Here. Here. This is what's happening here. Now. Here. And somehow for me, I've been finding that that kind of begins to kind of break the trance or the obsession about, you know, the past, future, my preoccupations. Here. This is what's happening now. It's very, very simple. It's very uncomplicated. I'm not trying to get anywhere else. I'm not trying to do anything. Just here. This is what's happening now. This. Oh, this. This. But I keep doing it. And that helps me a lot lately. And then after a little while, I settle down. The mind settles a little bit and it's not so running around so much, running this way and that way and the way the mind can run. Sometimes we notice that the mind is agitated for particular reasons. And maybe we've done some kind of transgression, something we've done something to hurt someone or done something that we're embarrassed by or something. And so it keeps us kind of mind running and moving. So the question is, how do we then engage in that in a useful way so we can learn to settle down and find the sense of well-being? Buddhism teaches the practices of forgiveness. Maybe you have to have forgiveness. Or the practice of compassion. Have a compassionate approach to yourself. Be very accepting of who you are. Not to be in conflict with yourself. And part of a spiritual process, I think maybe in most spiritual traditions, is learning how to be wise about what you encounter when you face yourself, when you face your demons, your darkness, your difficulties, your depressions. How to be wise about that. If you're not wise about it and try to rush ahead and have some great spiritual experiences, get concentrated or whatever, you know, it's kind of like doing a spiritual bypass. It's kind of like you're not really, really acknowledging who you really are at that particular time. I feel that part of a spiritual life is to offer is to be very respectful of where you actually are and learn how to be wise and compassionate to that and not be ahead of yourself. And again, I'll say that so much of the wisdom, so much of the maturation, spiritual maturation that comes with a spiritual practice comes with this initial period where we're simply learning to establish our mindfulness. So be really, really appreciative of the work that you have to do to establish your mindfulness. And as I go through the other kind of six factors of awakening, don't think that, oh, you know, mindfulness is elementary, or, oh, why am I not further along the way? This initial stage is maybe a really, really useful, really important aspect of practice. So slowly, we try to be mindful. We bring our attention to the present moment. We bring our attention to the breath, bring our attention to the body. And slowly, the mind that runs around, chases after thoughts and ideas, begins to settle down. In order for this to happen, also, it's helpful to know that the meditative process does not involve past and the future, does not involve problem solving about problems outside of the present moment. It's useful to problem solve. It can be useful to think about the past and the future, but not in meditation. If you want to get absorbed in the meditative process, you have to have some wisdom about how, oh, this stuff is not for now. I'm going to let go of this. I'm not going to solve my bank account now. You know, I'm just going to be engaged in this. It's just like if you're going to play, you know, I suppose if you're going to play volleyball. If you spend your time playing volleyball thinking about your finances or your job or your partner or lack of partner or, you know, all the different things, you know, your fellow volleyball partners are going to eventually kick you off the team. You know, because the ball hits your forehead. And, oh, I didn't notice. you're not there. And if you're really involved in play at some point, you know, these things have to drop away. So the same thing with meditation. So you know that the domain of meditation is to let go of these things. And that's a very important teaching to know, because the mind operates as if these things are really important. And we kind of are complacently sometimes willing to go along with the mind's tendency to want to think about things. So we have to be very, very wise about this, and not be judge the mind's tendency to be distracted or be involved in these things, not feel it's bad, because that just makes things worse. But rather just say, oh, here. Oh, so this is what's happening now. Oh, amazing. A person thinking about what to have for dinner. That's what's happening at present moment. Isn't that amazing? Wow. As I like to say, 5 billion years of evolution has come down to this. This moment, thinking about what's for dinner. You know, and so having this kind of like wow approach to meditation is very helpful. So establishing the mindfulness. As the ability to be present increases, to track what's going on increases, then our capacity to be discerning about what's going on increases also. Our capacity to be discerning, discriminating, to be able to distinguish what's going on in our experience increases. And this ability to start making distinctions in meditation is a very important part of the meditative process. So the next factor of awakening is called investigation. To begin looking more deeply, now that I can be present to some degree, can I look more deeply about what my experience is? Not to take it as a surface kind of view of what's happening, but begin looking more deeply, what's actually happening here in a deeper way than my first impression. First impressions sometimes are accurate and sometimes are not. Buddhism tends to say that first impressions are, this is a generalization, but Buddhism generally says first impressions are not accurate. So don't believe that. But you know, take it a little bit as a kind of curiosity thing. Oh, what's my first impression here? And look more deeply. What's going on here? And start making distinctions between, for example, what is useful to do with the mind and what is not useful. So this distinction that I've just told you, between a mind that's preoccupied in its thoughts versus a mind which let go of that and then engages in the meditative process, engages in the breath and being present. That's a distinction that is useful to make. And it's the function of investigation of the discriminating mind to make that distinction so that we know what the wise way is to keep going. To know what is conducive to greater peace. What's conducive to greater sense of well-being as we do this. So meditation does involve using our intelligence. It isn't just simply being quiet and not using, our intelligence. We use whatever intelligence is available to us to further the process of absorption in the activity. I would imagine maybe the analogy would be like a good craftsperson who is making some intricate piece of furniture, perhaps. And that craftsperson is completely absorbed in that work. But he or she has to use a lot of intelligence in order to, it's very engaged, intelligently kind of figuring out exactly what has to go and there and how to do it and everything. And the person hasn't suspended his or her intelligence to make the furniture piece. But the person gets really concentrated and feels like the world drops away and feels really refreshed from having done that activity. Using our intelligence doesn't have to exhaust us. It can actually refresh us, help us get concentrated, help us get us more engaged in the present moment. And that's part of the art of this investigation, is how to use our capacity, our intelligence, our investigation, our discrimination, our capacity to distinguish, to help us get more concentrated, more peaceful, more involved, rather than the opposite. So investigation is an important quality. What's really going on here in the present moment? How can I be more usefully present in the present moment? The next quality is, or the next part in the sequence, then, is application. Or the word is virya, which usually translated as energy. Some people translate it as persistence. So to be persistent, to apply yourself in a persistent way, in the practice, to be engaged fully. So you use your investigation to see, how can I be more fully engaged here? One of the exercises I give people for meditation practice is, at the end of their meditation session, to spend a minute or two reviewing what that last meditation was like. Hopefully without any judgment, good or bad, just, what was that like? How did that unfold, that period? And just track it a little bit. It has two useful functions. One is that remembering what has happened strengthens the muscle of mindfulness, because memory and mindfulness are closely connected. It also predisposes you, next time you meditate, to be a little bit more attentive to what's happening in your meditation, because you develop this kind of little extra interest. What's happening here as I go through my meditation period? It has another function, and that is, you can learn from what your experience has been if you review it. I've sat down and meditated, done my 45-minute meditation, whatever, and I mostly kind of wasted my time. I've done that. You know, thinking about this and that. You know, I got kind of calm. Sometimes I get a little bit calm, and then I get complacent, and I start thinking about things, you know. And then I get up, and I go do my day. But if I stop at the end of my meditation and review the last meditation, during the last 10 minutes of that meditation, I wasn't very engaged. You know, I was thinking about whatever. And I wasn't actually that attached or that obsessing about that thing. I was just kind of relaxed, complacent. And it would have been very easy for me to have been more engaged in the meditation process of that last 10 minutes. But I just kind of let myself slip. I think I'll try to be a little more engaged, to notice and track this a little more carefully. And when I do that, and then I come back the next time, I'm more predisposed to learn from my mistakes in the past, and to be more engaged in the process next time, not be so complacent next time. That makes sense? So spend some time reviewing. And one of the things you can do if you review is notice, did I apply myself as well as I could have in that last sitting? Could I have applied myself in a way that respects who I am in a little bit more effective way? Could I be more there? Now, you don't want to fall in the trap of thinking you're supposed to be a super meditator. I remember once I was flying back from, this is embarrassing, maybe I shouldn't tell you. I was flying back from having spent a year in Japan, practicing in Japan, and I was on the plane, and before being on the plane, I read this book about the monks of Mount Hiei in Japan, who do this practice for 1,000 days, I think it is. They, in the middle of the night, they do this marathon run, and they run barefoot or with, almost nothing, and they run with this dagger hanging from a rope around their neck. And they go through like all these shrines in this mountain, and they do this vows or something, some kind of religious service, but in front of each shrine, and they run further. And it's snow and it's wind and, whatever, hot. And they're always, doing this run. And they have this dagger because if somehow they don't succeed, they're supposed to kill themselves. If they somehow give up in the middle or something. And, so it's this great thing, it's a great heroic kind of. So I was reading this book, and I was fantasizing about how, when I get back to America, I'm going to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going to do this great practice, and this and that, and, and by the time my 6 o'clock comes around, I'll be ready for the day, and I'll be just... So you have to be a little bit careful about, delusions of grandeur, about how well you can do, and, just have a realistic sense of how to apply yourself better. So this application and the persistence is really important. The idea to be kind of keep up the regularity of practice. Be regular in terms of a daily practice. Be regular in terms of even in your sit in the morning or when you sit during the day. Have a regularity of applying yourself. Don't be discouraged by anything. Just keep doing it. Keep plugging away in a gentle, consistent way. Don't let the mind derail you. The mind is really good at that. And it's possible to, just within reason, to not let the mind derail you if you don't take the mind so personally. If you don't believe what the thought and mind tells you. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, it's like little pesky flies flying around the background. Just, I can't do this. This is impossible. I have better things to do with my time. Maybe I should, I need to think about something more important. You know, all these little pesky things that come up, and you just treat them as little flies in the background. Persistence is important. Or you start, and one of the flies that flies around is, this meditation is not going as well as it should. I am a bad meditator. And then we all go off on that train of thought. And just have this idea, oh, persistence. I'll just kind of be, sometimes stubborn persistence is really good in meditation. I'm just going to hang in there. And one of the reasons why stubborn persistence is good is that it's kind of like, I can't think of a good analogy. Maybe later someone will tell me a good analogy, but last week we talked about holding steady. Sometimes if you hold steady in a situation, everything kind of settles around next to it. The analogy that's given often is that of a pond settling, the mud settling. If you don't agitate the pond settles. So if you just hold steady sometimes, eventually everything else kind of follows and kind of gets aligned with it. So sometimes stubborn persistence is very helpful. But so the third factor of awakening is this a factor of persistence or engagement or application, applying yourself more fully. Applying yourself so you can get absorbed. If you don't apply yourself to reading the book, you're not going to get absorbed in reading the book. If you don't apply yourself in the game, you're not going to get absorbed in playing the game. You have to somehow apply yourself. And there's an art to application. And we learn the art by mistakes. The right kind of effort. Sometimes we make too much, we try too hard, sometimes too little. But the function of investigation, which we keep up along the way, is to start tracking how we apply ourselves. Is it a useful way? Is it too much? Is it too little? What's the right balance that helps me be at ease here, be peaceful here? Or what's the right balance that keeps me from being too exhausted? What is the right balance that keeps me from being too lazy? Or too relaxed? So mindfulness, investigation, persistence. The next factor is joy. Sense of inner well-being, delight. And it said that delight and joy can arise when we apply ourselves, so we start getting absorbed in the activity we're doing. Almost any activity, if we really get absorbed in it, tends to bring a kind of joy. I used to love, when I was in college, taking my final examinations. Kind of strange, right? And, it wasn't like I liked the examinations in and of themselves. But if I was well prepared, what I liked was the absorption I got into. And because there were they were consequential, so I get really, that energy of consequence. And I would really engage, for that 3 hours writing this exam. Writing. I wouldn't think about anything else except writing these little essays, whatever. And solving these problems. And everything else would fall away. My mind would get very concentrated. And I'd feel this sense of well-being. And I remember I would leave these classes where I'd take the exams. And I'd walk out kind of like, everything was fresh and new and great. So I used to look forward to my exams. I wasn't a particularly good student, but, I liked the exams. And so joy is part of the pattern of what arises as we get involved in this meditative process. I know that joy doesn't always arise. I know that for many reasons, when we sit down to meditate, we can feel depressed or feel grief or feel anger, feel all these different kinds of things. And part of the meditative process is to be very respectful of how we actually are, as I've said earlier. Maybe and not take it so personally. Not take all what happens to us so personally. But sooner or later, this aspect of sense of inner well-being needs to develop. And if you know that and kind of keep an eye out for it, then you can start noticing very small shifts as you meditate of feeling greater sense of well-being. It might be a very small shift. You feel a little bit calmer, more at ease. You don't feel so fragmented in your body after sitting for half an hour. You feel more settled. You don't feel this nervous energy in your body. So you start feeling little symptoms of inner well-being. Appreciate those, recognize those. And the appreciation and recognizing of those and knowing that they're supposed to happen can be helpful in allowing them to grow and develop more and more. And as they develop more and more, the joy can become quite strong. They can become the predominant experience in meditation is the experience of feeling delight and joy. As we feel some delight, some inner sense of well-being and joy and delight, then it's said in the Seven Factors of Awakening that tranquility arises. The mind, the body, becomes more calm. And this is the fifth factor. So mindfulness, investigation, persistence, joy, and then tranquility. The body, joy lets the body relax. As we get absorbed and engaged and happy, then we just relax our tensions. We relax this nervous energy and this bolting feeling and restlessness that might be. And the tensions of the body begin to dissolving a little bit. As the tensions of the body dissolve, the body feels more tranquil and peaceful. It's a lovely thing to feel. With a foundation of joy, happiness, tranquility, then it's a lot easier to get concentrated. That's one of the secrets of meditation. If you want to get concentrated, have this sense of well-being. And so then we develop our concentration. Concentration comes out of this. Concentration almost can rise naturally as we get calm and tranquil. The Buddhist tradition actually doesn't make a very sharp distinction between tranquility and concentration. In my first Vipassana retreat in Thailand, I had interviews with a teacher through a translator. Translated my words into Thai and from Thai into English. And I would say things to my teacher. I'd say things like, "Oh, today I'm feeling concentrated. Today I'm concentrated." And it would be translated into Thai, and he'd say something back. It'd be translated into English, and coming back into English, he said, "Oh, today you're calm." And I said, no, I'm concentrated. And another day I'd come and say, "Today I'm feeling calm." And it would go around, you know, and come back. "Oh, so today you're feeling concentrated." And and I didn't quite make sense of this. But I learned many years later that calm and concentration are very closely connected. So much so that people sometimes will translate them as the same. But anyway, in this list, their tranquility and concentration are different. But concentration is the capacity of the mind not just to be one-pointed, to be focused on what it's paying attention to. I think in the West, we think of concentration as kind of a one-pointed focus. But samadhi, or concentration, in Buddhism, involves a collectedness, a bringing together, a unification of our mental and physical being, so that our whole being is unified and composed and engaged in the same purpose, for the same purpose. So we're not just simply concentrating on the breath. Our whole being seems to be focused or inwardly to be supportive and engaged with the focus on the breath. So I like the word composed because that's more physical to me. We get composed on the breath. There's unification. All the tendencies to be distracted and be pushed away and have this centrifugal force away from the center fall away. And everything in our being becomes unified and collected for the purposes of being focused here. Then, so that's the sixth factor of awakening. The seventh factor of awakening is equanimity. And equanimity is often misunderstood. Sometimes people don't like the word equanimity because it suggests the idea of being neutral or being kind of indifferent. And that's far from what's meant by equanimity. I think maybe the best way of understanding equanimity is to first understand that it, in this sequence, it arises after all these wonderful things has happened. After your healthy, great engagement, after your joy, after tranquility, after your concentrated mind has developed. So there's a strong sense of inner well-being, a strong sense of inner preciousness, inner precious, something very precious is happening within your mind and your heart and your psyche. So a real sense of inner depth, inner well-being. And equanimity is when the mind doesn't leave that sense of inner well-being for anything. Normally the mind would leave itself all the time for things. Someone, I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know why this occurs. You have to, you know, this is part of the risk of talking this way. Is I come up with odd analogies suddenly on the spot. But you know, you're sitting here and you're feeling all this equanimity and peace and joy and this really sense of delight, inward delight, settled here. And someone comes into the room and says, "Hey, you know, you won the California lottery. It's $29 million this week. I saw on a sign. What would you do? What's more precious to you?" Would your mind then leap out of itself? What can I do with $20 million? Or I better protect this. I hope no one heard that. You know, all this, the mind does things, right? And gets engaged, and suddenly it's locked in on something. It's left that sense of inner preciousness, inner sense of delight in itself. Equanimity is that capacity of the mind where it's not going to leave, go out, or pull away, resist what's going on. It just stays in this kind of sense of well-being, this balance, this evenness of mind. If ugly thoughts arise, if beautiful thoughts arise, it doesn't go for or against them. It doesn't sacrifice, we don't sacrifice our sense of well-being because of that. We feel physical pain, or we feel physical delight. The mind doesn't go for or against it. The mind stays kind of collected and settled on itself. That's kind of, I think, what equanimity means, to be equanimous. So it's really arising out of a very wonderful state of mind to begin with. Does that make sense what I'm saying? So the mind doesn't react, but rather stays in this wonderful place. And that ability for the mind not to react and just stay in this balanced place, this equanimity, is kind of like the little portal, the little door through which we need to be in order to let go of, you know, all our attachment, the mind to really become free. So those are the seven factors of awakening. Once, there was a monk who was sick. And the Buddha went to visit him. Buddha was a good chaplain. And the Buddha sat next to him. And the Buddha recited the seven factors of awakening to this monk. He just recited them, maybe over and over again. Mindfulness, investigation, persistence, joy, and as the Buddha did this, this monk, those qualities in the monk were either evoked, we don't know what happened, or he was reminded of them in a way that somehow it gladdened his mind. And as these were evoked or gladdened his mind, he felt better and better. And he got, I don't know if he got well, but he got a lot better. Once the Buddha was sick, and some monk came to visit him and recited the seven factors of awakening to the Buddha and made him feel better. These are, you know, to evoke these things within us is very healing. And a person who's been familiar with these, we can evoke them sometimes to some degree. I say this as a way of ending the talk, is that the seven factors of awakening are useful factors to tune into in our daily experience, even if you don't have access to them in some deep meditative way. I think all of us have some very hints of meanings, hints of association, hints of sense of these seven factors. And to appreciate them, to remind ourselves of them, to find them within us, can be very helpful in all kinds of situations. Not just, you know, when we're going cruising along in meditation, but even when life is very difficult, can be very helpful. So may the seven factors of awakening be a source of great delight for you and joy. And may this talk, may the seven factors of awakening help you getting more absorbed in the present moment experience when you meditate. Thank you.